The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our online daily news site. He's here to share some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the Neanderthal diet. Neanderthals have long been thought to be our carnivorous cousins, obligate meat eaters that may have been outcompeted by us because of our more flexible diet. But recently, evidence has been stacking up to suggest Neanderthals did indulge in an occasional leaf or shoot. So, Dave, what were some of the first hints of a greener diet for Neanderthals?
Well, Sarah, there have been some recent studies on Neanderthals that lived in what is today Iraq, and there were studies done actually on the plaque and their teeth. And this indicated that these humans ate about as much food from plants as modern humans alive at the same time. And they also cooked barley grain. So some early evidence that they did consume vegetables.
But those were Middle Eastern Neanderthals. So there's still some room to say that in northern climes, Neanderthals only ate meat until this new study.
That's right. And one of the reasons researchers had thought that these Neanderthals in the northern climes would have just eaten meat or really focused primarily on meat is because they lived in this very cold environment. So they need this very revved up metabolism. The idea is the only way you're going to do that is if you're eating a lot of meat. But as you say, Sarah, this new study goes against that. This was a study done not on teeth, but actually Neanderthal fecal samples. This is actually the oldest fecal matter from humans ever analyzed. And these samples were somewhere between 40 and 60,000 years old. They found these fecal samples in five different locations at a site in Spain. They analyzed them, and they're looking for was chemical byproducts created by bacteria in the gut of these people, which indicate that plant matter was being processed, that it was being digested. And they actually found a lot of evidence for this, suggesting that the people that lived at this site, the Neanderthals that lived at this site, had a substantial amount of vegetables in their diet.
Well, so how do they know that this was Neanderthal feces, not human feces or dog feces or something like that?
Well, the specific what they call biosignatures they're looking for aren't created by any other animal except for primates. And there's no evidence there were modern humans in this site at this time. There's also no evidence that there were any other types of primates in the site at this time. So that just leaves Neanderthals as the primary maker of these feces.
Next up, we have a story on the temptations of tanning. I've often wondered why people tan, despite the warnings about skin cancer. I get it that it's considered attractive as a look, but now researchers are suggesting that there might be more to it.
Researchers are suggesting that tanning might be addictive. And the reason they're saying that is, first, there's some anecdotal evidence. There's been a real dramatic rise in skin cancers, almost 77% between 1992 and 2006 alone. Also, the tanning bed industry is growing extraordinarily fast, despite warnings that tanning can be bad for your health.
Just because more people are tanning doesn't mean that it's not a trend. What suggests that this might be an addiction?
Well, there's one intriguing piece of evidence that was collected before the study, and it's that tanners seem to experience withdrawal symptoms when they're given a drug that overrides the effect of opioids. And opioids are chemicals that are naturally produced by the body. They make you feel good. and it turns out when you disrupt that, people that tan don't have as much of an enjoyable experience when they tan. Also, people that tan seem to be able to know the difference between when they're sitting on a tanning bed that's emitting true UV radiation and one that's not emitting UV light, suggesting that our bodies are somehow picking up on something about the light itself.
Wow. They moved into mice and looked at what their response was to UV light. What did they find?
Well, they didn't take the mice to the Caribbean, but what they did do is they gave them a daily dose of UV light for 6 weeks. It was about equivalent to what a light-skinned person would receive by lounging in the midday Florida sun for about 20 or 30 minutes. So, decent amount of tanning. And the team measured things like opioids, signs that the mice were feeling pleasure from the UV light. And they saw a lot of this. They saw an increase in levels of beta endorphin, which makes the mice feel good. They also looked at the mice's tail position. And it turns out that mice's tails are normally floppy, but they straighten out when they're on opioid drugs like morphine. And that's also what the researchers observed when the mice were exposed to UV light.
And so that's a physiological effect. You see light exposure, you see a change in endorphin levels, other kinds of behaviors. But does this actually mean that tanning is addictive the same way drugs or tobacco are addictive?
Well, addictive is in sort of the eyes of the beholder. But one expert says that when we talk about addiction, we talk about things like stealing TVs to get high so you can sell, doing things that are very unhealthy for you otherwise, just so you can feed your addiction. And there isn't a whole lot of signs that people that use tanning beds are going to those extremes. But the study does suggest that on some level, there may be something that people are getting out of this activity besides a nice glow.
Lastly, we have a story on what makes us move. So, Dave, would you move if there was an earthquake in your hometown or perhaps the temperature went up 1 degree?
Well, I grew up in California and we had a lot of earthquakes and we didn't move because of earthquakes. So I'm going to have to say no to that question. And it turns out I'm not alone, at least according to this new study. This is a study of people that live in Indonesia, and the researchers wanted to see what types of factors make people move. And they looked at things like increases in temperature, earthquakes, volcanic activity, and it turns out the things you think might make people move, like earthquakes and volcanoes, have much less of an effect than things like climate.
So what kind of temperature changes are we talking about here?
Well, for the temperature changes, we're talking about changes that are actually fairly subtle. People that live in an area that maybe is about 25 degrees Celsius, the temperature going up by 1 or 2 degrees Celsius. And in those cases, you would tend to see people move, or the researchers saw a lot of Indonesian people move in those situations. If the temperature was below 25 degrees Celsius, they didn't see as much movement when the temperature increased a little bit. But it was when it got a lot hotter than that that they started to see people migrate away from the places that they were living.
And this wasn't because people were suddenly slightly more uncomfortable because of the temperature?
Well, they think it had more to do with higher temperatures can decrease crop yields, which is really bad for your income. So obviously, you're going to want to move to a place where you can support your family.
And what does this suggest about the potential effects of climate change on Indonesia?
Well, you know, researchers are really trying to figure out, because especially in places like Indonesia, climate change is going to have some fairly dramatic effects, not only in terms of temperature, but things like rainfall. But Indonesia is also subject to earthquakes and volcanic activity. So the researchers want to know what's going to be moving human populations in the future. And because we are going to have a lot of climate change, especially in this area, this study suggests that we may see a lot of migration away from certain islands in Indonesia onto other ones.
All right. So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about finding not one, not two, but 3 supermassive black holes all in close quarters to each other. Also a story about whether prison is contagious. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about attempts to beef up science education at black colleges. Also a story about, well, I'm just going to say one word, cyber dogs. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.